Good morning, everybody. It is so wonderful to be back. Let's start learning. First of all, I'd like to thank the Adlers who are sponsoring today. That's David's mother who's yahrzeit is this evening. We'd also like to thank Eliezer Cohen for sponsoring in the merit of his sister, Rachel Rivka Bas Yitzchak HaKohen, whose all yahrzeit is also this evening. And Ilu Nishmas Tal Bas Odeide, and David and Ricky's a relative in Israel whose Levi is in fact today. Our limud should be Lili Nishmasehem. Thank you for contributing to the schus of this limud Torah in their merit. So this particular shiur, Presidents in Torah, or Lessons from Presidents, it started a while back, and I just want to put a disclaimer on this. We'll call the disclaimer is PCE, which means present company excluded. Because if we're going to look at the last three presidents of the United States, then it becomes a political statement or a blame game as to who was right, and we're still pointing fingers in all different directions right now about blame. So the point of it here is not to attribute blame, is but to learn something. So we're going to stretch back for 42 other presidents, which we have a rich history of. And this really takes me back to a time when myself and my wife went to Boston for a vacation. And we did, which everybody should really do, any good American should do, is to take a moment to walk the Freedom Trail. Take a moment to enjoy what the Freedom Trail there. It is free, if I'm not mistaken. And one of the things which was most, I felt discomforting about the whole experience to me was the following. Was that I had just come out of a class in YU, and I'd been doing an undergraduate on postmodern literature theory. So I'd been learning a little bit about what postmodern literature means, and as of how it differed in style, in content, and narrative to modern literature, and the, we'll call it the super narrative of, or the sarcasm, or the satire of anything, the irreverence to everything. And I found that it was uncomfortable how irreverent the tour guides were to the founding fathers, to the framers of the Constitution of this country. And here I am, a person who deeply, deeply appreciates America, especially having come from the outside, having seen what democracy expresses itself and how democracy is different in other countries in the world, and what a blessing we have to be in America today. And it was uncomfortable for me. I went through that. We went through the founding fathers' graveyard, and just to give you an example, you know, there would be a across the street from it is like the original Sam Adams, you know, it's actually a store. And they, you know, and the tour guide says, this is the only place in the world where you can sip a cold Sam Adams watching a cold Sam Adams. And it went on. And Hamilton, this was before the days where Hamilton became all exciting on Broadway. You know, they had a lot to say about Hamilton. And each of the founding fathers, it was almost as if we'd forgotten what they did, and all we were focusing on was their idiosyncrasies. And I actually had a very interesting discussion with my professor, Professor Guy, about this, about the postmodern narrative of, we'll call it revisionist history almost. Meaning to say, let's remember what they did before we start criticizing them as human beings. And the reason why this is important to remember is the following. And that is, Hashem thought it was important to look at them with respect, and that's why there is a bracha, which Chazal instituted in brachas, which is that when you see a king, a non-Jewish king, there's a bracha we say, which is Asher Cholak Kvoido Lebosav Adam. Hashem gave his honor. A piece of Hashem is to be found in the kings. Now, there have been very bad kings in the history of the world and rulers, but let's not forget the majesty of who these people were. That's number one. What I'd like to do today is to take six examples today very briefly, and understand what a little bit of that kvodo, understand a little bit of that honor, and perhaps a lesson in Torah that we can learn and which we perhaps can appreciate from them themselves. Just going to plug ourselves in so we're not going to have any blackouts. Okay. Much better. I need to have a little space, so I'm going to split this over. Yeah, that's all right. Okay. Thank you so much. Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. Let's start, of course, if you start at the beginning. The reason why this is President's Day weekend, the history is that in the year following Washington's death, there was a unanimous celebration. I think we lost the bio. There was a unanimous celebration by people across the 13 states of the Union on his birthday, the 22nd of February. And it took a number of decades, and finally it was actually instituted into, it was legislated into law, and we have President's Day weekend, which is this weekend, of course, in honor originally of what it was originally General Washington and ultimately President George Washington. It's fascinating, of course, that there was George on both sides of that particular battle. Must have been confusing, which is why everybody calls him Washington. Nonetheless, that was a little bit of postmodern. So what I'd like to do is actually the one particular lesson which I found very fascinating is the following. We can look in the sources. I want to take us to the end of the sixth parak of Sefer Yehoshua. Sefer Yehoshua is dealing with the battles of entry into the land. Of course, it's a very unique moment in history. It's a time where there's this new conquest. Israel is, the children of Israel are finding the land of Israel. There's a lot of similarities in certain ways to the establishment of the Union to a certain degree. But be it as it may, what we have is an interesting episode where we have three psukim. We're told about a very mysterious encounter that Yehoshua has. This is between, after coming across the Yarden River, after circumcising Bnei Israel, who are not able to circumcise themselves in the desert, just before they're about to enter into the fray of Yericho, we're told the following. When Joshua entered into the area of Jericho, Vayisah eino vayar v'hinei ish omeid l'negdoi v'charboi shalufo b'yodoi, he sees a specter at night. He sees an image of somebody at night, and he doesn't know who this is. He doesn't know if it's an enemy. He doesn't know if it's a friend. So he reaches out to him, and he says to this person, remember, and this individual has their sword held up. And he says, are you for us or for our enemies? Daddy, don't need to do it. It's all good. So this is Vayomer. He says, "Loi ki ani sar tzvo Hashem ato vasi." He says, "I am the general of Hashem." So now we're not talking about a human being. Apparently, he was speaking to some form of spectre of Malach. Vayipol Yosha ponav arzav ishtachu Vayomer loi ma adoni medaber el avdoi. He says, "What do you want from me? I'm about to go to battle. What have I done wrong?" Vayomer sar tzvo Hashem el Yosha shal naalcha me'al raglecha. Can Yeshua is told to remove his shoe. Notice, by the way, plural or singular? Singular. As opposed to Moshe Rabbeinu at the burning bush, where it was two shoes, Yeshua removes one shoe. We need to just think about why that should be, that Yeshua differs from Moshe. It's very similar to the burning bush experience. And he takes off his shoe, and he knows he's standing on Adamas Kodesh. It's not the same area. He's on Transjordan here. He's in the land of Israel. Very similar episode. This is one of the comparison points to Moshe Rabbeinu. And what happens afterwards? What happens afterwards is the next perek. And Yeshua says, Yericho is Sageres and Musageres, and Yericho is a siege, a walled city, and the story continues. And you wonder to yourself, what happened? Meaning, what was the discussion? What was he coming to tell him? He was coming to tell him to take off one shoe. That was the point of the interaction. What is really going on over here? So it happens to be that the Chazal fill us in part of the conversation based on the words. It's almost like a code that they're speaking. So he has the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which says the following. So the Gemara says in the top of Mem Dalad Amubayis in Sanhedrin. Amalei, Emesh, there is a problem here. Bital Tem Tomit Shalab Ben Abayim. You had to stop bringing the regular korban on a daily basis because of the wars you're involved with now. There's no longer, the Mishka's not at this point set up. He says, "V'achshav bitaltem talmud Torah." Now you stopped learning Torah. Why? What does that mean? So Yehoshua asks him, which problem are you coming to criticize me about? Are you coming to criticize me about the Talmud or about Talmud Torah that we stopped? Amalei ata basi, I came because of now. What's now? What does he come for now? It says, Miyad uvayolen Yehoshua v'alaylahu b'soicha emek. Yehoshua dwelled that night in the valley. Notice that's two prokim later, which is fascinating. We have to work out why, what the gap over here in time is. What happened was in the middle of the battle, While everything was ensuing, you can imagine, you know, everybody's putting away their weapons from the day, they're going to sleep after a long day, probably haven't anything to eat, and what does he do? He establishes some form of base medrash, where people are now going to, we're going to meditate on halacha. And Omar Shmuel bar Unya, Mishmei Rav, Gadol Talmud Torah Yosef Mikor HaKravas Tamidim, Shnemar At Abasi, and then the Gemara says that we see from here that the problem of losing Torah during battle was even worse than the sin of losing the Korban Tamid. Really, an astounding passage. And the Gemara goes on to describe how each word, Yoshua says, Halanu Atala Tzareinu, is part of the question of which problem, and the Atabasi is the response. Okay, it happens to be, this is a bit strange, because, you know, like today even, like when you're in war is an all-consuming experience. Now, if you're on Shmirah, and you have a little bit of time, okay, you know, you can listen to a shir, you can pull out your little Mishnayos, maybe if you have an ounce of energy left. But what is he realistically expecting from him? So I notice in the Daf Al Daf, there's a beautiful description over here, which is found Rav Harav Miponovich asked the following question. Now, I wasn't able to find this inside, so I'm quoting it just directly from the Daf Al Daf. He says, Harav Miponovich bir boze. Tilechor yesh litmoya eich efshar lidroish miklal Yisrael beemtza shem sima matza milchamti. Is it really realistic to ask them about not studying Torah? Then listen, look what they're in the middle of. And by the way, this question is well asked by the Ponovitch Rav. The Ponovitch Rav was the man who got up from Europe, the man who rebuilt, and the man who traveled the world to rebuild Ponovitch, to rebuild the yeshivas of the world. He was the person who had every excuse not to be learning, because he was building Torah. And nonetheless, this is what this is his comment, and he says the following. That's why the Malach uses the word now. What is he saying? Remains to hint. The Torah says, where does the word Torah use the word va'ata? Now that thou shalt write this Torah. Torah should be so sweet to you, it should be the song in the background all the time. It should be something which is almost on the auto playlist in the back of your mind. It's not something where you bifurcate your life. It is something which is always there. When there was a respite from the battle, that was what came in. Now you think, wow, that's Herculean. How is that even possible? What happens to me is a very fascinating description of Washington himself. Now, Washington was better known before the War of Independence as General Washington, right? He was a soldier before he became president. There's a beautiful description over here of this particular battle in Valley Forge. So here we are. Surviving the harsh winter of Valley Forge in 1778, he insisted that divine service be performed every Sunday at 11 o'clock in each brigade which has a chaplain. Those brigades which have none will attend the places of worship nearest to them. It is expected that the officers of all ranks will, by their attendance, set an example for their men. While we are zealously performing the duties of good citizens and soldiers, we certainly ought not to be inattentive to the higher duties of religion. To distinguish the character of patriot, it would be our highest glory to Lord, L-A-U-D, the more distinguished character of Christian. The signal instances of providential goodness which we have experienced and which we are now almost crowned, our labors with complete success demand from us in a peculiar manner the warmest returns of gratitude and piety to the supreme author of all good. And I could just take a moment to imagine, you know, like, here's a professional general. He has thousands and not tens of thousands of people who are answerable to him in the midst of a very bloody battle. And one of the things he demands from them is, let's not leave God out of the picture while we're in the middle of this battle. What a remarkable moment. You know, he could easily say, you know what, folks, once we get independence, there'll be lots of time to set up churches and to pray to God. But no, in the midst of battle, we're not going to forget piety. Very biblical lesson which he's teaching us. And in fact, it's just a really beautiful description afterwards. At the conclusion of the Revolutionary War, George III, that's the George on the other side of the sea, heard that Washington was voluntarily laying down his sword to return to his beloved family and farm, and responded, if he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world. And of course, Washington did. Which is, you know, when you come back to that Gemara, and the way that the Ponovitch Rav understood it was, is Bein Be'ez Milchama, Bein Be'ez Shalom. That Torah is part of your life, Of course, Washington was not learning Torah, he was learning Bible. But at the same time, you just get a sense of the type of being, a glimpse into the type of being we're talking about over here. A person who is a magnificent human being in terms of both his military prowess, but also in remembering where he comes from. Let's move on to another lesson. We're going to move on to John Adams over here. Course number two, we're going with numbers. We're going to get pretty far in the numbers. We're just going to look at six particular presidents. Don't worry. Of course, John Adams was the second president, first vice president. So we're talking about. He actually, very interesting enough, he died on July 4th. There was another one of the founding fathers also died on July 4th, if I'm not mistaken. Jefferson as well.
Same day.
Right, and apart from each other, I think there was an interchange between them before they passed away. There was very interesting relationships between them. And, of course, he was a president until the early 1800s. So he had one term in office. And I would like to focus on one particular issue. And that is, we have lots of letters from John Adams. And the one is, let's go into appreciate a Gemara Megillah Yudalad Amabez. The Gemara Megillah says the following. The Gemara is talking about the new innovation of this new idea called Purim. So Gemara says the following. Tana Rabbanon, Arba'a v'shmona Neviyim, v'sheva Neviyos, nisnabu lahem l'Yisrael, v'lepofsu v'lo yisira al-masha kosu v'atara chutz v'mikra Megillah. You know what? Out of the 48 male prophets and the 7 prophetesses, who prophesied for all of Israel, they never added one iota or detracted one iota from the Torah. They extended, they supported, they protected, but they never added new halachas to the Torah except for one thing, and that is Mikra Megillah, because in Megillas Esther, as you know, Mordechai and Esther now said, this is what's going to happen in the future years, and you're going to read Megillah, which means to say there was no basis necessarily for this. So how did this arrive? My Darush. Where did they derive it from? Meaning to say, it couldn't have just been sucked out of somebody's thumb. How do they institute, as we're going to be doing in a few weeks' time, Mikra Megillah at night and day? So the Gemara says, Omer b'chia bar Avin, Omer b'yoshua ben Karcha, Uma me'avdus l'cheirus amrin ansher amitza, mimis l'chaim lo'y kol shekein. If from servitude to freedom we sing Shira, then surely from death to life we should. Where is avdus l'cheirus?
Mitzrayim.
So what essentially is the Gemara saying? That Mordechai and Esther understood that the model of what it means to say Shira is already there. We're simply extrapolating on that model in a more extreme case because we're talking about genocide as opposed to servitude. The Gemara says, Iyachi, Halal Nami Neiman. The Gemara now asks, oh, we should also say Halal. The Gemara gives 3 reasons why we don't say Halal on Purim. If you say Omrim Halal on Nesha B'chutz La'aretz, because it was in the diaspora. Asked about, yes, as Mitzrayim was also in that, we skip a couple of lines. Nachman says, Kriyasa Zu Halela, the Kriyas Megillah is supplanting the Halel. And finally, the last answer, which is, Hacha Halolo Avdei Hashem V'Halo Avdei Hashverosh, Akati Avdei Hashverosh, Anon, we're still in servitude to the Persian Empire. Be it as it may, what you see over here is that the Gemara is not willing to let Purim slide. The Gemara is not willing to say that, hey, it's all right to have a new holiday, because, hey, they can just say what they want. No. Where do they need to derive it from? Where do you derive a new holiday from? It needs to be from something which already exists. And what already exists? We have the model for what exists, and that is Exodus. Listen to this unbelievable letter. This is a letter over here between, this is a proposal for the seal of the United States, a letter by John Adams to Abigail Adams. And so we're talking about the 14th of August, 1776. This is pretty hot off the press. Okay, so this is a letter to his wife, and he says the following. He says, this is the anniversary of a memorable day in the history of America, a day when the principle of American resistance and independence was first asserted and carried into action. The stamp office fell before the rising spirit of our countrymen, meaning to say the previous stamp office. It is not impossible that the two grateful brothers may take their grand attack this very day. Okay, he goes on to describe it, and he says an interesting thing. Let's see, we're going to now go move down to the suggestions. Let's see over here. Oh, yeah. Okay. Here we go. Dr. F, so he's talking about who all the suggestions were. Dr. F, that's Benjamin Franklin, proposes a device for a seal. Isn't this awesome? You're talking about somebody who's interacting with these people, right? Dr. F proposes a device for a seal. Moses lifting up his wand and dividing the Red Sea, and Pharaoh in his chariot overwhelmed with the waters. This motto, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Now, of course, you know, it obviously was very pressing at the time, but obviously it wouldn't be something which necessarily would all relate to necessarily later on. But he says, and Mr. Jefferson proposes the children of Israel in the wilderness, led by a cloud of the day and the pillar of fire by night, And on the other side, Dr. Aberson, pronunciation of here, Hengist and Horsa. I don't have a very good Saxon pronunciation. The Saxon chiefs from Hengist and Horsa. No, about Saxons, it needs a little touching up. The Saxon chiefs from whom we claim the honor of being descended and whose political principles and form of government we have assumed. And he proposes, Adams proposes, the choice of Hercules as engraved by Gribellion. And now this, and he has a whole description. Now, it's interesting to me, like, you know, so he's going a little further afield, and he admits that his whole description is very complicated and probably won't be understood, and then really it's actually plagiarism. But nonetheless, what you see over here is that among the three suggestions, this is literally, we're talking about over here, we're talking about 2 weeks after every, no, 1 second, this is a short month after really independence is taking foot, and we're talking about what the seal of the United States is going to be. And listen to the biblical sensitivity over here. This is way after the Gemara said this. But where do we derive? What does it mean to have a new country? What does it mean to have a new holiday? What does it mean to represent this miraculous miracle? And what two of them do is they reach back into the biblical episode of Exodus itself. That's where we can start from. Now, they're not Chazal. We're not trying to propose that Chazal in any form or fashion. But remember, these are the framers of the Constitution. These are the framers of what America looks like today. And we should try to remember the biblical basis for it and where it started from as well. Just a very fascinating history, a historical point which relates to what we're doing. And then, of course, he asks for horses from his wife so he can get back to visit her. The next, of course, is Abraham Lincoln, the 16th president of the United States. We could just spend weeks and weeks talking about Abraham Lincoln, and there are many experts, some self-proclaimed experts and some real experts on Abraham Lincoln. There's so much to talk about Abraham Lincoln, really a very, very fascinating individual in many ways. I want to focus on one aspect of Abraham Lincoln, and that is... Abraham Lincoln was not Jewish. One aspect of Abraham Lincoln... who lived through and led the people through the Civil War and retained the Union. By the way, I just wanted to appreciate something I was thinking about recently. Just something so important, and that is that if you think about, you know, the difference between Europe and America today, and, you know, the European Union and all the... Think about how many wars have been fought between the different European states. And think about if they'd been one country with one language, all united with one economy... the power that would be vested in Europe today as opposed to America. Just think about that for a moment. Think about the number of states in America which all have one federal government, despite what California says from time to time, and despite what New Hampshire keeps saying, despite everybody who's deciding to secede from the Union and so on. It's not as much of a threat these days as it was in those days. But think about the power of a nation, one nation under God. Think about what that means, that you have 50-plus states now that are now under one federal government, contributing to one economy, speaking one language. That's an unbelievable, or the power of that. And Abraham Lincoln was the person who had to guard that ship to make sure that there weren't going to be two countries. Think of what he had to lead the people through. The middle I'd like to focus on in Abraham Lincoln is the middle of anger, just for a moment. So famously, as we described just a couple of weeks ago in Letters Flying Free with Dr. Abramson, we talked about the Ramban. Here's the beautiful letter which he writes to his son is the following. Tisnaheg Tomei, his first thing, he says, Shema bini Musar avicha v'al titosh Torah Samech. He says, listen, my son, he says, Tisnaheg Tomei d'daber d'vorecha b'nachas. Always speak calmly. Always. L'chol adam u'chol es. To every person at all instances. U'vazeh t'inotzel min akas. Shehi midah ro'a lach t'ivnei adam. Anger is a terrible, terrible characteristic. V'chein am rabbeseinu kol ha'kois, kol minei gehinom sholtim boi, all types of gehinom take control of the person. Notice over here, that the individual over here is the object of the sentence, not the subject of the sentence. The subject of the sentence is Gehinnom, the object is you. Because when you become angry, you lose control. You become the object of your anger, as opposed to the subject of the conversation. That's what the Ramban is saying over here. Remove anger from your heart and badness from your flesh, because usually the two come together, is what he's saying. And an evil person may day. When you're able to overcome this, and this is a lifetime of incremental work, you'll have a sense of humility, which is the greatest characteristic of human beings. Just to give you a sense of the extreme of this, this is the Rambam himself on Pirush Mishnayos on Maseches Avos. The Rambam says a story over here, which is so penetrating, it's very hard to digest this story, in fact. And but it gives you a sense of just how far this can go. The Rambam is explained, and he references himself. There's certain characteristics that a person, as opposed to the general golden mean of being in the middle, not to, you know, let's say his example of, you know, if you want to spending money, they're the misers, and then the people give away everything. He says, you've got to find a golden mean. There's got to be a middle. There's some characteristics you can't have a medium. You have to be able to go to the side. He says, Kadesh yikbab mitzvah ha'pu'ulos. You need to, when you need to fix things, you need to go to the opposite extreme. Chutz mizoy samidon levada bikolamidos retzori nema ha'gaiva. He says, arrogance is one of those you need to always be on the opposite extreme. He says, in order to avoid arrogance, by the way, which is often the root of much anger, is because you feel that it's coming to you, and therefore why should somebody else have stepped on that invisible line, because you are much more important than they are really treating you as. So he says, you need to go to the opposite side to adopt anava, to adopt real humility. And here's a story he tells. He quotes a book of characteristics. He doesn't attribute it. Happens to be some people, actually, some scholars say that this is referring to a particular Sufi Muslim scholar, which is fine because, and there's many articles written, and that's why Judaism is influenced by Sufism. The Rambam himself says, if you read the introduction to the Rambam on his Pirush Pirkei Avos, says that I'm going to quote from many people because I'm going to find MS B'Shem in the place that I said. I'm not going to tell you who it is. He says, because people criticize because of who I said it is. So I'm going to tell you the truth because I'm finding the truth. So he says the following story. He says, Shenishal le'echa men ha-chassidim. One of these pious individuals was asked the following. What is the happiest day of your life? Now let's try to think back for a moment. What would you describe as the happiest day of your life? Family, vacation, simchas, whatever else those happy moments are that you can think about. He says, oh my, listen to his description. Yom shal yisin osel gavesina. I was traveling on a boat. V'ayom mikomi bo hashofel shivakomas. All I had was the lowest deck. That's where I was. V'ayisin lavush b'luyeis chavos, and I was wearing these worn-out clothes. V'ayibasvina soicharim ba'le mamon. And on the coast, the top level, you know, with the aristocrats. V'ayisin shachevim komi, and I was lying in my little huddled corner. V'echa mi'amsha asvina. And then, of course, one of the aristocrats needed to relieve themselves. And he looks at me. He sees how lowly I am. The loneliness of my situation. And the man urinated on top of me. This is what happened. Listen to all these responses. I was like amazed that this person could be so brazen that he could do that to another person. I did not feel any sense of pain in this experience. I didn't get angry. That was the happiest day of my life because I did not respond, because I didn't even feel anger. Can you imagine? That's what the Rambam is describing. That is the extreme of what it means to be a person in control of their midos. We're not asking to put ourselves in these situations, folks. But in the end of the day, think how far this goes. Now, let's return to Abraham Lincoln.
By the way, the contemporary Baal Moser would call it
Bitul Yesh, absolutely. Self-negation to the nth degree. Let's return to Abraham Lincoln for a second. Happens to be, we're talking about 1863. We're now in July 1863. The famous battle of Gettysburg has occurred. General Lee is in retreat with the Confederate troops. They're moving southwards. They arrive at the river, and the Potomac is now swelled from rain. There's no way that General Lee can take his troops across the river. Abraham Lincoln has had general after failed general in his battle. And he finally realizes this is his opportunity to end the war. This is his moment to be able to take the opportunity to stop the killing. We all know how much Abraham Lincoln suffered from the deaths on both sides of this battle. And he sent a telegram. He sent a telegraph to General Meade. And he sent orders. He sent a messenger. Don't hold a war council. Attack immediately. Even though it's just been Gettysburg, attack now. Now's your moment to capture Lee, to capture the main army, and this will end the war. And General Meade did the exact opposite. He procrastinated. He sent response telegrams. He held a council of war. And by the time he got his act together, General Lee retreated across the river, and the war continued. And this is the letter that Abraham Lincoln wrote to General Meade, Major General Reed. And remember, folks, we're not talking about the caliber of people and the caliber of expletives that we see on the internet and the way that people don't know how to express themselves properly. We're talking about the President of the United States at this time, who and the degree of self-censorship. This, you can imagine how angry he is, but how the way he writes it is perhaps the most he could ever say this. He says, "I've just seen your dispatch to General Halleck asking you to relieve command because of your supposed measure, a censure of mine. I'm very, very grateful to you for this magnificent success you gave the cause of the country at Gettysburg, and I'm sorry now to be the author of the slightest pain to you. But I was in such deep distress myself that I could not restrain some expression of it. I have been oppressed nearly over since the battles of Gettysburg by what appeared to be evidences that yourself and General Couch, General Smith, were not seeking a collision with the enemy, but were trying to get him across the river without another battle. What these evidences were, if you please, I hope to tell you at some time when we shall both feel better." And he goes on to say the following. I want to get to the actual point where he describes his anger itself. Listen to what he says over here. I'm just going to actually turn to the page so we get the exact point over here. He says the following. Again, my dear General, here we are. "Again, my dear General, I do not believe you appreciate the magnitude of the misfortune involved in Lee's escape. He was within your easy grasp, and to have closed upon him would, in connection with other later successes, have ended the war. As it is, the war will be prolonged indefinitely. If you could not safely attack Lee last Monday, how could you possibly do so south of the river when you can take with you very few, more than two-thirds of the force you then had in hand? It would be unreasonable to expect, and I do not expect, you can now effect much. Your golden opportunity is gone, and I am distressed immeasurably because of it." That is unbelievably critical. "I beg you will not consider this a prosecution or persecution of yourself, as you have learned that I was dissatisfied. I've thought it best to kindly tell you why, Abraham Lincoln." What do you think General Meade responded when he got this letter? And the answer is, he never ever got this letter. This letter was found in the desk of Abraham Lincoln after his death. Now you can imagine something. Think about this. He wrote this letter, and you can imagine the anger he must have experienced, the pain and the frustration, and it was never sent. You can imagine sitting down in his office in the executive suite in Washington, D.C., and saying to himself, "You know what, I don't understand what it means to have fought at Gettysburg. I don't understand what it means to see the dead bodies of so many troops. I can't judge him. It's not going to help now." And he put the letter into his desk. Oh, wow. Now that is an expression of Kvod Ami, the boss of the Adam. Yes, what was that? It sounds like there must have been an exchange, and he did in fact he was relieved. But this was the letter that was after that, and apparently he wasn't willing to sign it. Let's move on a little bit over here into our next our 26th president, Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt, of course, the 26th president of the United States. He came into office in the early 1900s for two terms. Actually after an assassination. And I want to just focus on one particular issue. Mesidas Yesharim says about human development, the most fascinating insight into humans. And this, to me, is something, this particular paragraph is something which I think about all the time. This issue that the Mesidas Yesharim talks about. He says the following, Hashem places us in a world that there are so many reasons to distance ourselves from Him. There's so many things that pull us away, and most of them are these desires that pull ourselves away from being close to Hashem. And a person they will distance themselves from the great good. Now a person is therefore placed in a great war. All things in the world, good and bad circumstances are all tests. Good and bad circumstances are all tests. Poverty on one side and riches on the other. There's no freebie. There's always challenges. He says, "Kenyan she'omar shlomo." He quotes Mishle. "Pen espa v'kichashti v'amarti mi'ashem." When I get satiated, when I have too much enough. By the way, this is not just financial. This means emotional, psychological, in family, in status in society. When I have too much, then I say, "Who's God? Why do I need God?" That's the challenge. Is when your relationship with Hashem, when you have too much. "Upeni voresh v'gonavti." But when lest I have nothing and I have to steal and I have to go against other people. A person who can win the battle on both fronts is a person who is truly free. I remember that there's a family we used to spend Shabbos with many, many times. The name is Karp. And Michael Karp used to set at the Shabbos table a vort from Rabbi Baron. Rosh Hashiva of Tifrach used to say the following. You know that on Shabbos Mevorachim, on Rosh Chodesh, we say there's Yiratzon and all these wonderful things that we should have. We ask for Yirah Shamayim v'Yirah Schait and all these wonderful things. The interesting thing is there's a repetition of one of those things, and that is Yirah Shamayim, right? Yirah Shamayim is mentioned twice. We say Yirah Shamayim v'Yirah Schait, then we go all the a bunch of things, then we say Yirah Shamayim again. Why do we mention it twice? So Rabbi Baron said is that, you know, what happens is if you read this Mesilas Yesharim, there's Yiras Shemaim and Yiras Chet are responding to different beings. Yiras Shemaim is our relationship with Hashem. Yiras Chet is our relationship with other people. What are the Mesilas Yesharim saying? When we're in a state, of have, what's the relationship is the most threatened? A relationship with Hashem. We don't need Hashem anymore. When we're in a state of lack, what's the greatest relationship which is threatened? Where we react with other people. We turn to God always. But at that point in time, the way we relate to other people. So in between the Yiras Shamayim and Yiras Chet, we ask for Oshev HaKavod. We ask for great wealth. Once we ask for Oshev HaKavod, we need another injection of Yiras Shamayim, the relationship with Hashem, because of this battle that the Mesilas Yesharim is talking about. They tell a story about an individual. There used to be a man called Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Schmidt used to live on the park bench. And so Mr. Schmidt used to sleep every night on the bench, and there used to be a rich gentleman used to walk across from West End, and he'd sit in every morning and he'd read his newspaper, after he'd read his newspaper, he'd put it down on the park bench, and Mr. Schmidt every night would fill in the crosswords that on the newspaper that was left there, and then at night he'd use it as a pillow and cover himself with the newspapers, and that would be his subsistence. And one night, the rich man is in his apartment and he's reading the newspapers and he sees that Mr. Schmidt used to spell his name with two T's. Mr. Schmidt had been the winner of a crossword puzzle. And this was a very substantial prize. And it's about 2 o'clock in the morning. He runs out to the park because he knows where Mr. Schmidt sleeps. And he finds Mr. Schmidt and he wakes him up and he says, Mr. Schmidt, you won the crossword puzzle. You are now a rich man. And Mr. Schmidt gathers his senses. He looks up at the rich man and he straightens the two strings of his tie. And he says, "And what, may I ask, do you think you are doing waking up a rich man at 2 o'clock in the morning?" Pen, right, we also Oshev HaKavod, but you need a little bit of... immediately afterwards, it happens so fast. So this is what Mesilas Yesharim says, our battle on both sides. Let's return to the inaugural address of Roosevelt, okay, in 1905, so second term. He says a very interesting thing. When I was reading this, I just thought this was quite remarkable. Our relations with the other powers of the world are important, but still more important are our relations among ourselves. Remember, this is going to be the heralding in the age of American isolationism, okay, between First and Second World War. He says, our relations with ourselves, such growth in wealth, in population, and in power as this nation has seen during the century and a quarter of its national life is inevitably accompanied by a like growth in the problems which are ever before every nation that rises to greatness. Power invariably means both responsibility and danger. Our forefathers faced certain perils, which we have outgrown. We now face other perils, the very existence of which it is impossible that they should foresee. Modern life is both complex and intense, and the tremendous changes wrought by extraordinary industrial development of the last half century are felt in every fibre of our social and political being. Never before have men tried so vast and formidable an experiment as that of administering the affairs of the continent under the forms of a democratic republic. You see an interesting change over here. This is fascinating. If you take the list of the 200 richest people of all history, which means to say you prorate their money to whichever stage in history it is. So there's a list made of the 200 wealthiest people, and it's fascinating because the list, will move from Cleopatra to czars to billionaires in modern times to Bill Gates to certain Saudi officials, right? Across history, the richest people of all times. And there's something fascinating to notice about those people, and that 9 of them were born in the 1830s. 9 of the richest people of all time were born in the 1930s and made their business and their success in the 1870s onwards. Why? I mean, we talk about the Rockefellers, Carnegie. We're talking about the billionaires of all time. Why?
Industrial revolution.
So we talk about the Industrial Revolution, but also the following. Malcolm Gladwell talks a little bit about this moment. He calls it a window of opportunity. After the rebuilding of the Civil War, where the income tax code has not yet been stratified as much, and there are at this point in time very little regulations on labor, the expansion of the steel and railroad industries, you have tycoons moving into the market who got immeasurable wealth in their investments at this point in time, unparalleled by some of the people, Rockefeller, unparalleled by people today, how much money they earned. Why? Because we're talking about after the Civil War, when he's talking, just to appreciate what's going on over here, he is talking about a country which has succeeded beyond expectation. And what he's saying is let's not forget that there's another challenge which comes. It's not the challenge faced by the founding fathers, but it's the challenge of success. And this is his inaugural address, the recognition of that very salient point of the Missile Sashon, the battle on two fronts, which America started facing at the beginning of the turn of the 20th century. Let's move on to two last presidents for a moment, and that is we're going to face Richard Nixon, the 37th president of the United States. Why is this important? We're going to focus on one interesting, very fascinating line, and that is the following. But so we know a lot about Richard Nixon, but let's just focus on one interesting aspect. There's a discussion at the end of Parashas Vayikra about what's called a Korban Chatas. Chatas is an offering brought by a person who has sinned and needs to bring reparations for their office. And there's an individual one, there's a Kohen one, there is a communal one where the whole community was misled by the Sanhedrin, they bring a sacrifice. And there's one which is called for the Nasi, for the president or the political leader. So usually this introduction to the section is, Daber b'nei Yisrael emor nefesh ki sechta v'shkoga v'chom etzos Hashem. Any person who sins, asher ya loyse al sinu v'asa achas mehena, he brings a korban. However, later on in Pasuk Chof Beis, we're told the following. Asher nasi yechta, when or if your nasi, your leader, will sin, v'asa achas v'chom etzos Hashem erakom asher loyse al sinu v'shkoga v'Hashem, and he makes a mistake. Rashi comments famously and says, the word asher, quoting the Gemara in Horios, is actually related to the word ashrei. Ashrei means praiseworthy. Loshon ashrei, ashrei hador she'anasi shelo nosen leiv lahavi kapara al shigagosoi. Praiseworthy is a generation that their leaders are willing to bring a shkaga even on unintentional actions. Praiseworthy is such a leader who's willing to admit guilt. Of course, as we remember in the Frost interviews with Nixon afterwards, there's a famous line, as we all know. Second, here we go. I think we lost our power, our sound. Hang on for 1 second. There we go. Let's try again.
Missing minutes.
It looks like it was censored politically. It looks like it was censored politically. There's the question that Mr. Frost asks President Nixon in the interviews thereafter is very intensive. Is he said, he asks him if what he did was illegal. And the response was, if the President of the United States did it, it is legal. And there's a moment in there that was like that got down to the key moment of Nixon's self-reflection. And that was lacking the ability to say, Asher Nasi Yechta. That there's a time where even presidents can make mistakes. But say you can make a mistake. Asher Nasi Yechta. The lesson from President Nixon. And finally, Ronald Reagan, the 40th president of the United States. I want to just focus on really one interesting thing. This is actually Halachic Sugya over here. The Halachic Sugya is talking about, can you steal micro measures from other people? So can you, the example the Gemara talks about is, can you, if you're walking past somebody's fence, can you take off a little splinter off their fence to use as a toothpick? Right, so is that a problem? Because in the end of the day, meaning the fence is still there, right? It's not going to really affect his property. The way this comes into effect is, let's say, when you're using, halakhically today, you're using somebody else's Wi-Fi without their usage. So the incremental usage of their bandwidth, is going to really change the way that they're going to use their internet, right? And the answer, and this is a big halakhic discussion, so Gemara in Yerushalmi says the following. Rabbi Shimon bar Kahano have a masmich l'Rabbi Lezer Avron al-Chad Kerem. So Rabbi Shimon was accompanying with Rabbi Lezer by one vineyard. Amalei, I see lichad kis, michtzed shinai. So he says, bring me a splinter to use as a toothpick. Chazav amalei, loitaisi liklum, don't bring me anything. Amar, de'ein I see, kol barnosh, u barnosh, miaver kein, ha izil siago de guvra. If every person be taking a toothpick, there would be no fence. So even though I'm not destroying the fence, we can't contribute to the destruction of the fence, says the Gemara Yerushalmi. Paskin da halacha, the Magid Mishnah says, also the exalt kol shehu din Torah, and then he goes into a discussion of the mixes of Farshim, if there's no ma'ahak poda on this, but nonetheless, the Midas Chassidus quoting this Yerushalmi is, not to take even an incremental amount of another person, because we are contributing to the to the disruption of this person's property. This is a very fascinating halachic sugya when it comes to issues, let's say, intellectual property, things which can't be measured necessarily, but you're taking up, really, we'll call it, very small measures of other people's property. Very fascinating discussion in the halacha. Why is this relevant? Fascinating letter which is found in the letters of Reagan, and Life in Letters, pages 664. He says a beautiful letter. So this is actually a letter to Andy Smith. And the letter that Andy Smith, a young boy, sent was, "Today my mother declared my bedroom a disaster area. I would like to request federal funds to hire a crew to clean up my room." Okay, remember now, by the way, we're talking about, this is strong Republican, right? We're talking about the Reagan-Thatcher era over here, right? So he's not got the right address for this letter. But nonetheless, so he responds the following. He says, "Dear Andy, I'm sorry to be late in answering your letter, but as you know, I've been in China and found your letter here upon my return. Your application for disaster relief has been duly noted, but I must point out one technical problem. The authority declaring the disaster is supposed to make the request, and in this case, your mother. However, setting that aside, I'll have to point out the larger problem of available funds. This has been a year of disasters, 539 hurricanes as of May 4th, and several more since, numerous floods, forest fires, drought in Texas, and another earthquakes. What I'm getting at is that funds are dangerously low. May I make a suggestion? This administration, believing that government has done many things that could better be done by volunteers at the local level, has sponsored a private sector initiative program calling upon people to practice volunteerism in the solving of a number of local problems. Your situation appears to be a natural, to be natural. I'm sure your mother was fully justified in proclaiming your room a disaster. Therefore, you are in an excellent position to launch another volunteer program to go along with the more than 3,000 already underway in our nation. Congratulations. Give my best regards to your mother. Sincerely, Ronald Reagan." And what he's saying is that, look, folks, in the end of the day, you want to make society better. Do it! Because it might be a toothpick from the fence, but at the end of the day, you're building a fence in the opposite direction. Every single act which you do, whether it means to say cleaning your room, is bettering the country. Because if you have a clean room, and therefore you have a more gratifying life, and you have a better job, which contributes to the GDP, which contributes to a better society, all together we all flourish. And that is perhaps one of the lessons we take from Ronald Reagan. So when we say the bracha, "Asher nachalak kvodoi lebosav adam," there's so much to learn. We just need to peek inside. Wishing us all a wonderful President's Weekend. Thank you. Rabbi Chanani ben Akash, Omer Atzah, Kodesh Baruch Hu, Nezakos Yisrael, Fidah, Hir Bolayim, Tzorim, Yisrael, Shnemar, Anach, Ovet, Zaman, Tzikva, Yagdil, Torah, V'yadir.